Although a college degree often leads to financial security, it can be hard to finish in tough economic times. If you do decide to drop out, turns out it's never too late to go back.
My nephew and niece got this thing going. He asked me if I'd be interested in going back to school and getting my license, you might say.
That's Leo Plass. In a few months, he'll be 100 years old. When he decided to go to school for a degree in teaching, the year was 1929.
This was all during the Depression. Things were kind of hard going then.
Plass put his money in the bank, but it went broke, and he couldn't pay the bills. That was when a friend offered him a spot in a logging company, and even though he only had one semester left, Plass dropped out.
I needed the money to live on.
Plass went to work in construction and traveled all over the country.
But I spent probably 25 years down in Yuma, Arizona, where I worked for a contractor down there. Every year, after elk season, we'd go down there and spend the winter up until about April the 1st, and then it got so hot you couldn't even hang on to your tools.
Eventually, Plass ended up in Redmond, Oregon, where he still lives and spends his time building birdhouses, picture frames, and chairs for children. So when his nephew showed up and asked if he wanted to get his diploma, he was just a few credits short of his teaching degree. He said,
I'm just too old to do it.
But then he thought it over and decided he wanted a college degree.
I was the first one that went through the line of about 700 of them up there, and which was about 600 more than I figured it would be there. It was really something out of this world, I'll tell you for sure.
He now has something to put in one of those picture frames he makes, a diploma from Eastern Oregon University, 80 years after freshman orientation. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Laura Sullivan. Americans are counting their pennies these days, taking a close look at everything from the cost of milk to their mortgage. And that means it's time for the age-old question.
For years, we've been told the surest way to make more money is to invest in yourself by getting a college degree. But with the cost of college rising faster than inflation,
many are now asking,
is college worth
the price of admission?
Is college really
worth it?
Is college really worth it? Or is it the big lie?
College does cost three times as much as it did 30 years ago. But since World War II, a house and a degree has been the American dream, a sign you've made it. In 2009, more than 70% of high school graduates enrolled in college, almost twice as many as in 1960. Could so many people be wrong? That's our cover story today. Why do we continue to question the value of a college diploma?
What you see, if you look at the news stories over time, and really going all the way back to the 1970s when they first started to appear, is that a real formula has emerged over time.
Kevin Carey is policy director for the education sector, an education policy think tank here in Washington, D.C. He could write a college graduate horror story in his sleep.
You start with some kind of very alarming, attention-grabbing headline.
College graduates may be no better equipped for the work world than high school students.
And then you find a recent college graduate in the worst possible circumstances to lead off your story.
Chris Alfred followed the crowd at his high school and went to college and grad school. Now he owes more than $125,000.
The key is to find someone who just graduated from college who's working in a terrible job.
I work at a call center and I make $10 an hour and I feel like a loser.
And living in just the most abject circumstances. They're on food stamps. They've moved back in with their parents, much to their parents' alarm.
I'm just about broke and I'm about to graduate, so it's time to pack it up and go back and spend some of my mom and dad's money.
And then from there, you sort of start to broaden the thesis.
Everybody is nervous.
And say something like, people are increasingly questioning whether college is worth it.
A recent survey asked thousands of students at hundreds of colleges, would you go to your school again? About 40% said they would not.
You track down an expert.
The bachelor's degree, it's America's most overrated product.
And then you finish with a quote saying, my life is terrible, I'm in a dead-end job, I'm sad, I'm hungry.
Frankly, I'll take what I can get because right now I need money.
What is to become of me?
We'll get back to Kevin Carey in a minute, but first, one woman's story that sounds pretty familiar from two decades ago. In 1989, Melissa Burke headed out to the University of Florida, even though people told her it might not help her get a job. And when she graduated 4 years later, it was pretty bleak.
There was a lot of kind of static or tension in the air around whether or not we were going to be able to find good jobs that would really set us on our way for careers.
It was the middle of a recession. She started to look for work early.
So my friend and I decided just to head out and see the country and really face the career issue or the lack of jobs or whatever in the fall rather than deal with it right off the bat in May. So when I started looking, there were a lot of resumes sent out and a lack of calls back and a lack of interviews. And I was very aware of the struggle or the perceived struggle in terms of landing that first job and starting off on that career path. You know, I remember hearing the stories. I mean, I was featured in an article that the headline was Grads Without Jobs.
You wouldn't know from that 1993 Washington Post headline that things were about to take a turn for Melissa Burke, which you'll hear in a minute. And that's one of the things that drives Kevin Carey crazy. He's the policy director at the education sector. And when we talked, I asked him, what's so bad about this kind of story?
It's missing a lot of really important long-term trends. If you look at wage data, people with college degrees are making more and more and more money. And basically everyone else is either staying the same or falling back. So the economy has expanded a lot, but basically college graduates are the people who have reaped the benefits of that, and non-college graduates have really struggled to stay ahead.
So, why do we love this storyline so much?
Well, I think the kind of people who read the New York Times and the Washington Post tend to be more college educated. And so this really tweaks their anxieties. If you're a parent and you've spent your whole life trying to get your son or daughter into a good college and spent a lot of money, the last thing you want to hear is that that was a bad idea and they're going to be coming home and they'll be unemployed soon. And so people gravitate towards stories that speak to their fear and their anxieties.
So, I mean, we've heard this story over and over again, this question, mm-hmm. Is college worth it? But it seems to really have hit a nerve lately. I mean, you have venture capitalist Peter Thiel paying kids to skip college. Why is it taking off so much right now?
We always see a spike in this kind of story during economic downtimes because, of course, when there's a recession, it's harder for everyone to find a job, including college graduates. Although, again, I would note that even in this most recent terrible recession, college graduates were less likely to be unemployed before it started, and they were less likely to lose their jobs after the recession happened. And in fact, only college graduates, they're the only segment of the economy where employment has actually gotten better during the first 5 months of this year. But the other reason I think that there's this level of anxiety is that college is much, much more expensive than it used to be. So when people are wrestling with that cost-benefit equation, the cost part of it has gotten bigger and bigger, and so their sense of how much the benefits ought to be has risen as well.
So what do you say to people who feel like they have just been cheated by the higher education system?
It is possible to be cheated by the higher education system. We've seen a lot of intention in Washington, D.C. over the last year about abuses in the for-profit higher education industry. The Obama administration took action just a couple of weeks ago, in fact, to put in new regulations that would prevent predatory for-profit colleges from inducing students to take out tens of thousands of dollars in loans for degrees that often have little value in the job market. This is not to say that everything is totally fine and that any college will always be worth it. But the long-term trends about the average value of a college degree are very strong.
Is that what the economists say, too?
Economists like to argue with one another, and so there is some dispute in the field about this. But you look at somebody like, for example, there's a labor economist at Georgetown University named Anthony Carnevale, who has calculated that on our current pace, we are going to produce 3 million fewer college graduates by 2018 than the economy will demand. That if you look
fewer.
At the new fewer. So we're not producing enough right now. And that's because if you look at the fastest growing job categories, they tend to be jobs that require some level of post-secondary education. And we have this continuing phenomenon of old jobs that have been around a long time being redefined upward in terms of the skills that they require. and employers will be looking for those people with degrees.
That's Kevin Carey, policy director of a think tank called the Education Sector. He joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Remember Melissa Burke? Well, what Carey said about a college degree paying off in the end was true for her.
So I saw an ad in the paper for a job of desktop publisher secretary. I applied for that job, got it. And I think, you know, for me, it was not my ideal career path. You know, I didn't go to college for 4 years to be a secretary. But I really saw it as an opportunity to start working in the field, you know, that I knew I wanted to be in. I started out, I was supporting the director of membership and communications. And, you know, 5 years later, I had her job. So taking that, you know, initial step of doing a job that maybe I perceived as less than ideal really, you know, was the first step to kind of, you know, starting my career.
Melissa Burke now runs her own HR consulting firm in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Now to the economic picture back at home. Last fall, with the U.S. economy growing at a tepid pace, the Federal Reserve made an unprecedented move. It began buying up long-term government bonds from investors as a way of pouring money into the economy. Many economists say the program probably helped stimulate growth, at least a little. Now it's supposed to expire, and Fed officials say it won't be coming back. NPR's Jim Giroli has more.
Fed officials never used the term themselves, but a lot of people have taken to calling the Fed stimulus program quantitative easing.
The purpose is to perk up the economy, which it did at least for a while.
Sun Won Son is an economist at California State University. He says the first round of quantitative easing took place in 2008 when the Fed bought up mortgage-backed securities and other assets. In the second round last fall, commonly known as QE2, the Fed bought up $600 billion worth of long-term treasury bonds. It's a huge amount of money.
When you flood the economy with money, reducing the long-term interest rates like mortgage rates, housing and mortgage markets are obviously helped. Also, with more liquidity in the economy, the value of the dollar declined, and that promoted our exports.
Not everyone agrees that QE2 has had its desired impact. The economy grew in the months after the program was started, but that could have been due to other factors. Economist Lewis Crandall of Rights and ICAP concedes that by flooding the markets with money, the Fed probably lowered mortgage rates a bit. But, he says,
the cost of this is that we've set a really ghastly precedent.
Crandall points out that by buying treasury bonds, the Fed is essentially lending the government money. That's not a big problem now because interest rates are low and there are plenty of people who want to buy U.S. government debt. But he worries that if conditions tighten, the Fed may come under pressure to buy more debt as a way of helping the government solve its budget problems. That, he says, could lead to higher inflation. As of now, QE2 is set to expire at the end of the month. In a speech in Atlanta this month, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke noted that the economy faces a number of headwinds, like higher oil prices.
In this context, monetary policy cannot be a panacea.
To economist David Malpass, president of the consulting firm Encima Global, Bernanke's words were a clear signal that the Fed is done trying extraordinary measures like QE2, at least for a while.
He's just saying, look, let's be realistic. The Federal Reserve can't cause growth, can't cause employment. And so there's going to have to be other tools, hard work within the economy. And I think he really meant better policy out of Washington in other areas.
Even if Bernanke wanted to extend QE2, he probably couldn't right now, says Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Baker says QE2 was highly controversial with some other Fed officials, and they probably wouldn't vote to extend it.
It's a political issue, I think, not literally a lack of tools. It's simply that given the makeup of the Open Market Committee, he lacks the majority needed to really push any further.
Baker says that's a shame because he believes QE2 could help the economy at a time when it badly needs it. Baker believes the program helped lower long-term interest rates by 2 to 3/10 of a percentage point. That means lower mortgage rates, which means more people can refinance. And he says that ultimately helps the economy grow.
But let's say it's something. If we could raise GDP growth by a quarter percentage point, that's not huge, but that's still talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs. It seems to me, why not do that?
With the program ending, Baker says some of those gains could be gradually reversed. But some Fed officials believe the benefits of QE2 have been less than clear, and at any rate, they're far outweighed by the risks. So an attempt by the Fed to stimulate growth is ending just at a time when the economy is showing new signs of weakness. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Economic troubles aside, Americans are finally getting some relief from high gas prices. In fact, this past week marked the fifth consecutive week of falling prices in the United States.
The biggest reason was that prices were too high in the first place. I mean, the $4 and $5 and $6 talk was really hyperbole.
That's Tom Closa, chief oil analyst with the Oil Price Information Service. The national average for a gallon of regular fuel is now $3.65. That's around 25 cents less than a month ago.
The $4 numbers are really disappearing. I really suspect that most of the country is going to see $3.25 to $3.75 during the summer.
But there is a scenario which could lead to even lower prices at the pump.
If sovereign debt worries turn into a worldwide contagion and you see a recession in Europe or in the United States, then prices could drop, but that's not something you want to root for.
Many analysts warn that gas prices could spike since global demand for crude oil, a key component in gasoline, is high, and there's always a chance for supply disruptions, particularly with unrest in the Middle East and our coming hurricane season. Tom Closa says it all amounts to discernible shifts in consumer behavior.
In April and May, people drove less. In June so far, people are driving about as much as they did last year. My suspicion is that when they get 401k reports for the second quarter in July, that they may drive a little bit less. Because I do think that regardless of the drops that we see, we're still going to be paying probably 75 cents on average more than we paid last year.
And for anyone thinking about planning a trip this summer or purchasing a new car, Closa says we've hit a baseline price for a gallon of gas.
I don't think that anyone should think about paying less than $3 for any sort of sustained period of time.
Tom Closet, chief oil analyst with the Oil Price Information Service. You're listening to NPR News.